and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for today's thinking procrastinator. Every week we look at what's happening in the world of music, TV, books, film and whatever else we fancy, and with the aid of our special guests we try to work out what it all means. This week we're joined by Dan Meyer, award-winning comedy writer for Harry Hill's TV Burp, The Peter Serafinovich Show, Charlie Brooker's Weekly Wipe and Sky TV's detective spoof A Touch of Cloth, amongst many other things. Dan loves Newcastle United FC and The Fall, both of which have made him well accustomed to fluctuating lineups and variable performances. Hello, Dan. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank
Jolly
you.
Jolly good. Are you enjoying the brief interregnum between the return of football? What are you looking forward to for the season?
I am. Weirdly, it's the most, post-relegation, it's the most optimistic Newcastle fans have been for eons.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's now everything to gain and nothing to lose?
There's quite a lot to lose if we don't get promoted immediately. There's everything to lose.
Is the appointment of David Moyes filled you with joy as well?
It's a sideways move, but in terms of charisma from Sam to Moyes, I'm not overly concerned that suddenly they're going to get away from us.
Yeah. Now, you've as a writer for Newswipe as well as other things, you must be. Are you looking forward to doing 2016 Wipe? It's been an apocalyptic, horrible year.
The process of doing. I tend to work on the review of the year thing more than the sort of series, which has sort of disappeared a bit because Charlie has so many other commitments. But we do the review of the year thing, and my role on that normally starts in about October.
Yeah.
And this year it started about a week ago.
Yeah.
Because there's that much news, we kind of thought, well, we better get together and actually work out how the hell we're going to...
It's light on gags this year, isn't it? And heavy on misery.
In fairness, though, I think we say that every year. When is news ever fun?
Mm.
There's a lot of news. We seem to have... It's news-a-rear.
Yeah. We're producing more news than we can consume.
Absolutely.
Mm. Also with us is returning Big Mouth guest Michael Moran, writer and general internet person for a slew of outlets from BT.com to The Guardian to late lamented things like The Quirker and The Word. 1,000 years ago, Mike was in the quiffed up 80s white soul band 5TA, and if you look carefully on YouTube, you can find them on The Tube. Hello, Michael. What are your main memories of being on The Tube?
My main memory, actually, is Paulie Yates tickling me on the tummy.
Oh, right.
And I ran away because I'm British. It was the same day she met Michael Hutchins.
Thank God you weren't Australian, I was going to say.
Yeah. Things could have gone either way there.
Yeah.
It could have been a very different story.
If you'd responded more positively to her advances,
yes,
how different the story could have been.
What else happened at the Tube? Was it like load in, do it and get lost, or did you manage to mingle?
No, it was very... it was like a kind of family kind of situation. You know, the crew were quite welcoming and nice, and we went down the pub afterwards and beforehand. In fact, I sat up all night getting really hammered with most of BAD the night before.
Oh, right.
Which affected my performance slightly.
Well, I've seen you on the clip and you're kind of propping yourself up on your keyboard.
I'm warmed through.
Warmed through, very nice. Also with us, as ever, maintaining high standards of sonic reproduction for you, the Big Mouth listener, it is our very own Phil Spector. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. Panning like a don't know what. And how are things with you?
Well, very, very good, thank you, yes.
Splendid. Okay, well, it's been a big week for geeks. We've been buried under trailers for new Marvel and DC shows and movies because of San Diego Comic Con. As is now the custom, the tasters for Wonder Woman, Justice League, Luke Cage, Iron Fist and the Defenders instantly became shareable, relatable content all over your Facebooks. We'll talk about them in a minute, but first, here is a taster of the tasters.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to be, as a friend, as a friend, as an old enemy.
You think the four of you can save New York? You can't even save yourselves.
The taster for Marvel's new Netflix series, The Defenders, with Nirvana, of course. So from the Comic-Con releases, we saw DC's Wonder Woman and Justice League movie trailers, plus Marvel's Luke Cage and Iron Fist, culminating in that ensemble show, The Defenders. Don't we miss the days when Comic-Cons were actually about comics? Mike Moran, what stood out for you from this bunch of trailers?
What stood out for me most was how much Justice League didn't stand out. Yeah. I mean, I have been waiting for a Justice League movie now for half a century.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out, and it was the least interesting thing that came out of Comic-Con. Yeah. I was quite excited about Wonder Woman. I damn near lost it over Iron Fist. I thought it was very, very exciting.
Yeah.
And Luke Cage, I lack adjectives to describe how excited I am about.
We may need to rewind a little bit because not all the listeners will, sadly, not all the listeners will be as mired in this stuff as they should be. So Justice League is effectively DC's attempt to get some of the Avengers action. It's the ensemble movie with Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman.
Yes, but it's got a history. I mean, the comic has a history, hasn't it? It is kind of like one of DC's kind of premier Marky titles, and you know, it's like the Avengers.
It is the super
for Marvel,
group,
yeah.
Mm. So I actually thought that the Justice League show looked quite interesting because you've got Ben Affleck, Batfleck, putting the team together in a very, very clear, you know, doing exactly what Tony Stark does in Civil War. But there seemed to be a bit of humour, a bit of badinage between him and Wonder Woman, and, you know, it doesn't go too well with Aquaman. I hear you talk to fish.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a, you know, there's a bit of a...
It's by no means a terrible trailer. Mm. It's, you know, I'm sure it'd be a very serviceable movie, but it's just how low it is on the top. It should be the most enormous event in popular culture for a decade, and it's just like, oh, here's another film now, thanks.
Yeah. But should it, though? Because is the title, is the brand a mainstream thing? Is it like Captain America? Is it like Superman versus Batman?
Know, Captain America.
Do people who don't read comics know what Justice League is?
What you've got to remember is that Iron Man and Captain America and Thor, these were totally unknown quantities even 7 years ago. Nobody had heard of any of them, and now they're massive, massive global things. They really were.
Marvel sold off their premier guys to Sony and Fox, and like X-Men you'd heard of, Spider-Man you'd heard of. But Iron Man was very much a second... obviously, I like him, because he's a disabled superhero and he's got a moustache and he drinks a lot. These are all things that I care about. But he was very much a second-tier title and they made a massive star out...
Robert Downey Jr.
made a massive star out of Iron Man. But prior to that, he was nothing's too far, but he was unimportant.
Yeah. Dan, what was your take on the massive trailer-gasm?
I'm fascinated by this because you know how non-football fans are before a World Cup?
Yes.
That's kind of how I am.
Right.
Listening to this discussion,
it's like,
I am completely, it's a complete other world for me. And I'm afraid I am of, and I feel like you're not allowed to say it anymore, but I am of the it's for kids school when it comes to comic books and comic book adaptations. I don't get it. So all the stuff you're saying, well, people know this, but they don't know that. I don't know that.
You don't know any of it, yeah.
So it's quite interesting hearing what you think is the sort of register of what's in the public consciousness and what isn't, because I'm probably quite a good...
Yeah. See, I'm actually with you, because I think when it's at its best, when this stuff is at its best, it is for kids. It's for the bit of you that's still a kid that loves the idea of, you know, Iron Man being able to punch a robot through a wall and Spider-Man.
But then why do grown-ups get so annoyed about the casting of these things? And this is a sort of it seems to be a real thing that I can't believe they've cast this person
really
as that. I don't understand why that is a thing when people don't get annoyed about the casting in Pixar films, for instance.
Yeah, but surely the whole point is that finding Dora... No, kids didn't grow up reading Dora comics, imagining the Dora voice in their heads, whereas they have done that with Wonder Woman, Miss Marvel, Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing is that what works and what has worked best for all of these, certainly the Netflix adaptations, is the fact that they're using characters you know, they all kind of had 30 book runs in the kind of mid-80s or late 70s and then folded because they weren't very popular and very successful. Mm-hmm. So actually, Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist are very much kind of, you know, they'd be...
They're championship rather
well,
than
Well, I'd even go down to League One. Yeah,
League
I'd
one.
Say,
well,
you know...
I mean, what's a football team that was big in the 70s and you don't hear about anymore?
Fulham.
Nottingham Forest.
Okay, well, that's what Luke Cage was.
Yeah,
was Iron Fist came out when there were a lot of kung fu movies.
Well, that was it. Luke Cage was the blatant attempt to take the kind of Black Power market into the comic books. Whereas, Iron Fist was their version of... Yeah. Fists of Kung Fu or the David Carradine series.
Overgrown child men like me, Matt and Mike will remember, of course, that Luke Cage and Iron Fist...
Heroes for Hire.
That was the whole idea of the story was these were rubbish heroes who couldn't earn a living and they literally had to rent themselves out. They put an ad in the Village Voice and said, you need a superhero, we're available.
So Luke Cage, kind of postmodern...
Yeah. And they were really charming for that reason, really likable. You know, anybody can... You know, if you're a billionaire and you've built the super suit, you've built your your Batman outfit and your Batcave, you've built your flying Ant-Man suit. Well done. You're a billionaire. Of course you can do that. When you're totally skint like poor old Luke Cage, you can't even hold down a job. That's when it's a proper superhero outfit.
This is the thing that, I mean, if they're stories about people to some extent, then that's more interesting to me. But I suppose I'm like someone who isn't a wine expert saying, well, they all taste the same to me. Yeah. And I look at these trailers and think, all I see is a sort of commonality of...
Well, that was interesting.
You've been given a special power. And then somebody who's given a special power decides that they don't want that power. It's all about the internal struggle of what they do with the power. Then they learn to use the power. Mm. And then there's someone who has an opposite power. And then they have a big fight where someone punches a house.
Well, that was interesting
down,
thing.
And then they throw cars at each other. And then the bad guy loses, but doesn't die because there has to be a sequel. That seems to basically be...
The way you're putting that, it's like a bad thing. This is exactly
It's not a bad
life.
Thing the first two or three times.
No, I disagree. It's good... Every time.
Yeah.
It's like a Big Mac.
It's performing the task that Beowulf or kind of Grendel did when we were all hunkered around our fires. Yeah. Because it's just telling the story again and again.
If there were five adaptations of Beowulf that came out in 1 year, though, you'd be...
In the year 300, they were saying, oh, man, I don't like this Beowulf reboot.
Could have taken at least an hour out of that.
Yeah,
in my head, Grendel doesn't talk like that.
Yeah. Well, just looking specifically at one that I think is not going to be the same as all the others, Wonder Woman, because, A, it's the first female superhero to kind of get a proper marquee thing, and, B, I thought it looked really, really good.
It looks really cool.
You know, for the listeners may not have seen it, but it runs through from the First World War to the present day. So she's an immortal. She's from the island of the Amazons, and she's a warrior princess. And it appears to be how she integrates into the modern world. But the main thing it's got going for her is, for a kickoff, Gal Gadot, who's playing Wonder Woman, is absolutely stunningly gorgeous and can pull off these action sequences incredibly well. And it looks like it's got a charm and a humour that wasn't there at all in Batman vs Superman.
I was slightly disappointed to not see any sign of an invisible plane in the trailer.
Well, you wouldn't see it, would you?
Do you see what they did there?
Yeah.
Now, the contrast.
Yeah, the golden lasso of, yes, chemtrails from the invisible plane. Yes. Just looking again at the Marvel ones as well, because Dan, you were just saying that the stories are all the same. And I can see, as an outsider, you'd imagine that they were, but the Netflix series are very much about life on in the real world. So Daredevil is essentially a crime drama that happens to have a blind guy who wears a horned helmet in it for some reason. And
I mean, Jessica Jones as well must have been
a private story,
the superhero character and superhero product in that first series, which with the least amount of actual superhero stuff.
Yeah, and in fact, often in, particularly in Jessica Jones and sometimes in Daredevil, you kind of think, this really doesn't need any superheroics in it at all. It's a really good street level New York drama,
which I think was possibly one of the reasons that maybe the second series of Daredevil kind of didn't necessarily work, because there was an awful lot of superhero stuff.
There was a good deal more.
Yeah.
Those Netflix one for me, it's essentially, it's The Wire, but then again, every now and then, McNulty pulls on some tights and punches another gentleman.
Now that I would like to see.
Well, that's what I'm seeing.
Which is pretty much where The Wire was heading by series 5.
Daredevil is my favourite television show ever.
Okay, that's enough overgrown man-baby talk. It is, for all the wrong reasons, still the year of David Bowie. His death has produced a flurry of books about the life and works of the Dame, including The Age of Bowie by Paul Morley, infamous enemy theoretician and proud zenith of the genre of pretentious music journalist. Is the book any good? We're going to find out in a minute. But first, from the just-announced Bowie box set, Who Can I Be Now? Brackets 1974-1976, close brackets. Here is the title track. Who Can I Be Now by David Bowie, recorded in 1974 and, incredibly, left off Young Americans in favour of Across the Universe, which is rubbish, isn't it? It's a rubbish version of Across the Universe.
I don't care for it much, but then again, you know, it's... I like David Bowie so much that even his bad stuff is good to me.
Yes, that's absolutely fair enough. So we're looking at Paul Morley's new book, The Age of Bowie, where he takes a, shall we say, poetic and theoretical look at the life of the Dame. Morley sets himself the task of writing the book in 10 weeks, and it's 150,000 words long, so he hasn't exactly censored himself. Dan, you had a dip in. What did you make?
I've had a dip. About 70 pages in. It does seem as much therapy as biography, as much about Paul Morley as about David Bowie. And in a way, he's sort of protected himself by doing that deliberately and quite openly, I think.
Yeah.
sort of protected himself from criticisms, accusations of indulgence by sort of making that the point of the book, I suppose. It's difficult because I think, I feel like in the wake of Bowie dying, we were also immersed in clips of 1980 TV performances we'd never seen, yeah. and think pieces and bits of interviews with everyone from, you know, Visconti to Gaylord Orsi, somebody he went to school with in the 60s, and all the stuff about email exchanges he had with people that didn't know whether it was really him or not, and all this sort of stuff, that it felt cumulatively like we've all been researching our own Bowie biographies.
Yeah, we were all instant experts.
So, and, which is something actually Pete touches on in this book. So it's kind of, I've got a bit of fatigue, I think. The timing is strange. I mean, I understand the timing is that he gave himself this 10 weeks, but I think there was a period immediately after Bowie died when I think we all wanted to absorb this stuff. Mm. And perhaps a year or two hence, I would want to absorb it at greater length. Mm. Now I sort of feel like I need a break just when this book has come out.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who picks up a Paul Morley book definitely knows what they're getting into. It's not going to be dry and forensic. It is going to, but it's going to fly off into the world of J.G. Ballard and Baudelaire and Jean Genet and all the rest of it. And he does deliver at that level, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Mike, what did you think of the...
I didn't care for it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care for it for a number of reasons, most of which Dan's already touched on. The fact that the first three chapters are essentially about Paul Morley and you're either a fan of his or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he does get on to talk about David Bowie, there's a kind of history of David Bowie told in the historical present, which I don't particularly like, punctuated with these long lists of... So David Bowie is a tub of Dairy Lee. Mm-hmm. David Bowie is, you know... 3 weeks in Corfu.
It's all referencing the V&A.
Yeah, these are the epigrams.
They go on at extraordinary length.
We should probably explain that a little bit to the listeners. So these are a bunch of epigrams that Morley wrote for the David Bowie Is catalogue and the exhibition. And things like David Bowie is inside his own head. David Bowie is yearning for a future that will never come to pass. David Bowie is cultivating the power to charm. It's that.
These double-spaced lists of those made me feel very much as if this should have been one of those think pieces that came out, like a two-pager, four-pager maybe, quite interesting, with some lavish pictures of Dave we'd never seen before and we'd all like it very much. As a think piece, I like it.
Mm.
As a book, it makes me want to roll on the floor and hug myself. It's just...
But not in a good way.
Not in
there
a good way.
There are a lot of lists. There's a list he talks about... Bowie astrology, that bit where he's talking about how we can all be defined by our sort of Bowie star sign. Are you low with Lodger rising, or are you a tin machine with that insane rising? Yeah. Okay, I get that now, but he lists about 30 of those.
Yeah.
I get it after the first
That couple. Would have been a banging one-pager in Jackie magazine in 1978. What it's doing in a book today, I've got no clue.
I think it's quite interesting because what Dan said about the timing and the length. Because I've worked with Morley, I've kind of commissioned him for stuff and produced him. He does have a most amazing ability to kind of fill all the space that you give him, which is good, both a good and a bad thing. He's got ideas kind of coming out of the wazoo.
Yeah,
a lot of them are stuff that when an editor works, you know, when you can work with him to come out with some really kind of quite special stuff. This feels like, because of the timing and because of the length, that maybe there wasn't the editorial process would have been, you know, made a kind of book that slightly shorter, would have taken longer to come out, but be maybe a bit more focused and kind of palatable for those who aren't necessarily full-on Morley heads.
But for me, the theory side that works is this idea that Bowie was behaving in a way that no pop star had behaved before, and that he was constantly, you know, the sort of the cartoon of David Bowie, the chameleon of pop, he was always changing his look. It's much deeper and stranger than that, and much more modern, because it's the beginning of modern society where everybody creates themselves, everybody decides who they want to be, and they're all straining to be. You know, he makes this interesting point that every Bowie album is the debut album. It's always the first one, you know, and he bins stuff off long before it's been completed, because he's always straining, bins off people as well long before he's come to the end of his time with them, simply because he's always straining to be something new, which I thought was really interesting. It's also full of Morleyisms. He describes the you know, Bowie's famous eyes as the unbalanced pupils are explicitly the entrance and the exit of his fantastic imagination. Well, that's one way of looking at it, I suppose.
Kind of gives him license. I mean, he loves him so much, which is fine, and I admire the obvious passion about it, but he sort of has this construct that everything that Bowie did was part of David Bowie, the creation, the project, whether it was right or wrong, whether it was good or bad, which sort of lets him off the hook a bit. He even sort of says, it's a bit where he says the project was to hide himself. He wouldn't give anything of himself.
Yeah.
Everything was about the creation, the real David Jones you would never know. he wouldn't give anything away, even if in when interviews he was asked a straight question, he would give a straight and honest answer, even that just fed back into the construct. Well, maybe he was just giving a straight answer. It's just part of that whole sort of picture that everything he did was all part of the artifice.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't really leave you anywhere to go, doesn't really give you any purchase.
Yeah. It's definitely, it's a huge argument for David Bowie as confirming the Paul Morley worldview of pop, isn't it? As, you know, that artifice and surfaces and self-construction are the way to go about things. But, you know, I don't think you can deny, I mean, it's clearly, it is a fan book, and he has been researching it since he was 10 years old and doing it pretty well. And the fact that he can look at something that, he can look at a song that Bowie wrote at the age of 5 and see how it throws forward to Black Star, the songs that he was writing as he was about to die, I think is pretty impressive. I don't think there's too many writers around who would have the mental architecture to be able to put that together. And also, it can be pretty funny, I think. I mean, he's describing Bowie staying with his early manager, Ken Pitt, one of the great tradition of gay British pop managers. A happy lodger, David would dance naked around the sitting room, revealing an almost totally hairless, pasty skin and bone body and a large and unruly penis. That's, you know...
Who's his?
Yeah.
Someone else's?
Just in a box. Yeah.
Well, the dame famously well endowed. And, you know, there is humour there, and I think there's great warmth to it. But I think it is fair to say that you will either love this book or it will drive you to madness.
Yeah, I think you need to be a Paul Morley fan rather than a David Bowie fan. Mm.
Okay, moving onwards, or perhaps sideways, because sideways is the way that David Bowie goes or went or is going. Are we going up or are we going down? Sorry, that's enough Paul Morley. Enough Paul Morley.
David Bowie is busting for slash.
Yeah. This week sees the release of I'm a Freak Baby, a journey through the British heavy psych and hard rock underground scene 1968 to 1972. It's a triple CD compilation featuring everyone from household names like the Pink Fairies, Uriah Heep and the Groundhogs, to slightly lesser known artists like Crushed Butler and Sweet Slag. We'll discuss this singular moment in British music in a minute, but first, from the album, here are the Yardbirds, who you will have heard of, with Think About It. With, as Michael Moran points out, I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, a.k.a. Think About It, from the triple compilation of hard psych and early heavy rock, I'm a Freak Baby. So, Dan Mayer, you used to run a psych and freak beat club called 13th Floor for the uninitiated. What is psych?
Oh, what is psych? I think the word psychedelia was first attached to music in about 1965, 66, the 13th Floor Elevators, Texas Garage Band. I think possibly the first band to be called psychedelic. It's really just the addition of drugs to rock and roll.
Right.
But new kinds of drugs. I think when sort of rock and rollers on weed graduated to acid, and that the way it influenced their music, the way it influenced the vocal style, that sort of very nasally kind of...
But psych itself, psychedelia is one thing. Psychedelia is floral and it's teacups and English one, but psych itself is kind of grittier and more brutal and
psych
nasty.
Psych rock is what that then turned into, and that's what we've got on this compilation, which is something that seemed to take over in about 1968. And I'm kind of fascinated by that period. It's the kind of psychedelic hangover, really, the post-Carnaby Street, when all the flowers had died and all that stuff had sort of faded away, what was left, what that boiled down to. I think it's a really sort of evocative period. I sort of picture change from 67 to late 68 as, by late 68, you've got men, unshaven men in army surplus greatcoats in basement flats in Latimer Road with nothing but a 3-bar fire and some heavy Victorian furniture, and it smells of damp and weed and nothing works, and they've got to go out to the mountain grill and get a... It's kind of an egg sandwich, and that's what's left.
It's kind of with Nail and I.
It's with Nail and I, and it's performance as well. I think that those two films really sort of evocative in different ways of that that horrible, greasy, everything's
it
gone.
Sounds
all,
horrible,
all the fun
Dan.
Stuff has gone
Why
away.
Why do you like it? It's so horrible. Why do you like it?
I think it sort of it prefigures the modern student in a way. Really. I think that's part
of Neil
what it
from
is.
The Young Ones. It's his band.
There's a sort of slight melancholy about it, about the onrushing 70s and what they promise and what they don't promise and how all that sort of that brief summer of 67 thing is kind of illusory. And the same thing was happening in America, I think, with Haight-Ashbury. The peak of Haight-Ashbury was like a matter of weeks, after which all the sort of muggers and rapists, and they were, it was, the horrible things were happening in San Francisco even by the end of 1967. Yeah. And it's, I find that sort of quite fascinating, and how that then translates into the music, as all that, all the flowery stuff goes, all the sort of, all the Alice in Wonderland stuff disappears, all the Edwardian military jackets disappear, and all that kind of stuff. And it turns into this boiled down, lumpen, heavy rock.
Yeah. Mm. And what did you make of this record in particular?
Most of it. Well, the things that I liked, sadly, when you get a compilation like this, you want to discover new things that are great, and I didn't. The things that I liked on it were the things I kind of already knew: Groundhogs, Pink Fairies. I like the fact that your accent turned the Pink Fairies into the Pink Furries. When you were, I actually thought I'd missed a band called the Pink Furries, which is actually a better name. That's the kind of stuff I like. There's one or two other things, like Escalator by Sam Gopal, which is a quite interesting track because it's actually Lemmy, pre-Hawkwind Lemmy. And there's one or two others. What interests me, because I do like the psych stuff and I like the garage stuff, is where you see that kind of cusp of the one turning into the other, where it's heavy rock but it's still got psychedelic traces. Yeah. So there's things on here. There's not much of it on here. Garden of My Mind by the Mickey Finn is quite well known. It's on a lot of those psych comps because it's a heavy psych track. The Open Mind are on here, but there's a better Open Mind track that exemplifies that. There's better music for me that works at the cusp of psychedelia and heavy rock. This all tips over in too much to me into the heavy rock stuff. But it's interesting in that it sort of prefigures heavy metal. It's a sort of a cousin of krautrock, a lot of this stuff. I think stuff like the Deviants, you can see the sort of politicised, slightly squatty collective connection to German stuff like Amon Dool that would have been going on at the same time. It prefigures kind of pub rock as well in certain ways. So a lot of stuff sprung from this, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah.
For me, just my personal tastes, I do like a bit more of the colour rather than the grey washed out.
Yeah, the thing that the famous graffiti, Cats Like Plain Crisps, you know, that sort of early London graffiti nastiness, everything's in black and white, seems to sing out from this. Michael, as a poncy London clubber turned raver, I imagine this is exactly the kind of music you hate.
Well, I can't say I cared for it, but it also made me think about something.
Right.
Which is that historically, we've always blamed, like, you know, the received wisdom is we blame the emergence of punk, or the necessity for the emergence of punk, on these, like, florid bands like Yes and Pink Floyd and, you know, and what's the other one? Camel.
Yeah.
We're about the lowest of that tier.
Lothar, please.
Who are still great. I still listen to Yes records. I still listen to old Genesis records, and they're still great. Everybody listens to them. Everybody who still listens to them still thinks they're great. This stuff, this is why we had to have punk rock.
Right.
This all had to be washed away. This crud round the edges of rock. It's this landfill metal. These people don't, in my view, and I appreciate that I'm judging them harshly, but that's why I'm here. Don't have anything to offer musically. It's all like, it all sounds like bands that I've been in where you get up and think, haven't really got an idea, gonna play it anyway. Just rotten. Every note of this was rotten. There's apart from Fireball.
Fireball is good, isn't it?
It's a banger.
Also, I think you see the influence of stuff like Led Zeppelin here, where people have gone, oh, we can be all sexual now.
Yeah. Mm.
Where there's this desperate attempt at sort of masculinity and sexuality that just seems a little bit pathetic because they can't carry it off the way that sort of Robert Plant could carry it. If you know, I mean, there are camps to say that Robert Plant couldn't carry it off either.
One that stuck out to me for hashtag problematic was Twisted Trip Woman by Sweet Slag. Come on, women, and get
something woman. God is a real thing, though. That seems to be one of the themes.
Should I Get Married Again? That's definitely going to be played as, like, you know, first dance.
Yeah,
Sweet Slag's Twisted Trip Woman, but you've also got The Phoenix's Street Walking Woman and Velvet Fog's Yellow Cave Woman.
Hawkwind Zoo's Sweet Mistress of Pain as well.
So basically, there's a Guardian think piece on every on every track, isn't there?
There's also a BuzzFeed quiz on, is this a terrible band made up by an inept novelist, or is this a real group?
An actual. I found it, obviously not my cup of tea, very short on drum machines and you know, Italian house pianos, but almost none to be heard, in fact. But I did think it sounded a little bit punk rock, actually, in its brazen disgustingness and its brazen embrace of scabby, filthy, as you say, with nail. I mean, the scribbled notes I had on this said things like bad weed and paint thinners, and rather than weak tea in a Red Guardsman's jacket, that kind of thing. It's just... It's these guys are what, when I was a kid, they were known as trogs. It is trog music. Trogs and the stonk, and they were, and they looked like Neil.
Without sounding like the Trogs.
Without sounding like the Trogs, no. And, you know, and it was very much a different generation from mine.
It's very much down the bill at the Roundhouse. You know, you'd go to see somebody, but and I can, then lower on the bill would be, and then there'd be that guy Jesus at the front going nuts.
But I can see, if you happened to be 19 at the time, how incredibly exciting this would be, because it was your first opportunity to be disgusting. That you'd been offered, you know, and a new levels of disgustingness, which is terribly exciting when you're, you know, when you're.
And it did influence. I said, Mark E. Smith's first gig was the Groundhogs in 1971, which maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some significance.
I'm never going to do that. Yeah.
but you know, you mentioned like the Move and the Groundhogs, but were the vast majority of these people success? Presumably, was on the other platform. Waving them bye-bye when their train pulled in.
But
none of them.
Clearly made records.
Yeah.
Admittedly, they made records in a time when it was perhaps rather more forgiving than it is today, when you could just about get a record deal just still by having long hair, because there were still old guys who were still running the business who didn't quite know what these young kids liked. So we'll give these guys a run and see what happens, which doesn't particularly happen now.
Yeah. I mean, it is remarkable just how much, I mean, like a lot of these sort of, shall we say, connoisseur or enthusiast scenes, it always amazes me just how much stuff there is.
Yeah.
You know, how much stuff is. And, you know, Dan, you know this stuff, you know, kind of inside out. Does it still surprise you how deep down the rabbit hole it's possible to get?
I mean, this stuff specifically, I'd know less of anyway, but I mean, it is diminishing returns, certainly. I mean, the stuff that I like, the psych stuff I like, you look at the Nuggets box sets, there's two Nuggets box sets, which are brilliant. Which are like four CDs each. Mm. There's a lot more that isn't on there that's also brilliant.
Yeah.
But then you get a few Pebbles compilations and a few of these things, and you've pretty much covered it. Once you're getting sort of highs in the mid-60s, volume 14, the Wisconsin sound, you kind of think, I don't think... Out of these 10 tracks, I'm reckoning maybe one might be any good.
It's a bit like, you know, you listen to Sounds of the 60s on Radio 2, and we're all, you know, we're in conditions to remember the 60s as a high point in pop music where everything was great, until Brian Matthew pulls out some of that right old tat, right real, like, you know, Landfill Motown, and just muck.
My favourite Sounds of the 60s moments are the ones where he's a producer, obviously shoehorns in a Velvet Underground track and he introduces it, and then you can come off the back and he's kind of going, and that was Venus in Furs, and you could hear the disgust in his voice.
Electricity levels spike up and down the land as kettles go on and people, you know, Well, I mean, doesn't that just prove, as the repeats of Top of the Pops have proved, that at any given time, and even at the greatest time for music, most of it is rubbish. And that's okay. Because
of course, it needs to be.
Yeah. You know,
most TV is rubbish. Talk about the golden age of sitcom, where you go back in and most of the 9 out of 10 sitcoms are rubbish.
Pop music should be ephemeral. It shouldn't be, you know, poured over by Paul Morley. It should just be like, oh, this is on the radio. I quite like this. I'll probably never hear it again.
I think you can have both. But I find it really salutary, like a lot of people, I think, watching the Top of the Pops repeats, to see the TV research version of 1977 completely overturned. Mm. You know, you see a TV clip show and it's always 1977. The whole country had gone punk. The whole country was buried in bin bags. The whole country was wearing safety pins. No, that whole country was listening to Brotherhood of Man.
Yeah,
as it always, you know, everybody always, you know, the participation in these supposedly epochal moments is very, very small, as it was in 1967, as it doubtless was in 1966.
Incredibly small London-centric thing, which is why on all those 60s documentaries you still see that guy going through the racks on I Was the Lord Kitchener's Valet.
Absolutely,
military jacket. But, you know, that's what's interesting. I'm saying, you know, 68 was might have felt very different to 67 in London, but I imagine in Carlisle, 1969, 1966, 1967 all felt pretty much the same.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to another touchstone of the 1960s. This one reinvented for now. Star Trek Beyond, third in the rebooted series, topped the US box office charts this week. In Britain, it was actually beaten by the big friendly giants. So is Star Trek suffering from franchise fatigue, perhaps? We'll talk about it in a minute, but first, let's have a listen to a bit.
Is that music?
It's a good choice.
Hey, well played.
We got no ship. No crew. How are we gonna get out of this one?
We will find hope in the impossible.
Well, at least I won't die alone. Well, that's just typical.
hey, you, don't watch that, watch this, Star Trek Beyond. Well, should we watch it? Was it any good? After the mixed reception for Star Trek Into Darkness, the one with Benedict Cumberbatch in it, this one brings in Idris Elba as heavily made-up villain Kral, and a plot about an ultimate weapon and a threatened Federation outpost. So, Mike Moran, what's your take on Star Trek Beyond?
I thought it was serviceable. I thought it was an adequate blockbuster, of which there are a great many. It's sort of, there is a formula for how these things are made. I thought it was, you know, we are often, you know, we're often thinking of Star Trek as quite a cerebral, brainy, thought-provoking kind of property, but it really isn't most of the time. Most of the time, it's just, you know, Wrath of Khan was the best received of the original movies. It's just a great action movie. Nobody thinks very much in it. Similarly, what's the one with the Borg with the Next Generation? Oh, it begins with I.
Insurrection, Insurgents.
Something like that. Impetigo.
Yeah.
Star Trek Impetigo is a cracking action movie. The only thoughtful ones are things like the first Star Trek movie, which is dull as, and just like loads of... It's just the last 10 minutes of 2001 for 2 hours. This was a serviceable action movie. Somebody rides a motorbike in it for no reason that is clear. There's some old, like, you know, some old Public Enemy played for no reason that is clear. People fire guns. People get transported in and out of things. There's that standard CGI cloud. Every movie now has to have a cloud of sort of mysterious angry dust.
Things. Yes, yeah.
That's there's some that template's just come out. See, it's like the wah-wah pedal of modern CGI. Everyone has to have a go.
Getting into the, you know, the gist of the movie, because to me this felt like a TV episode punching way above its weight. It's, you know, Star Trek has always been about exploring space and boldly going and final frontier and, you know, discovery. There's none of it in it at all. This is a pointless sequence of events that could well have been rewritten to happen on Earth. The gist is Kirk takes on a routine task and is punished for his overconfidence. There's a terrible status quo shattering moment which leaves all the crew stranded on a planet.
Well, the quo are in it.
Yeah.
Well, if only, yeah.
Fantastic.
And that's about it.
You know, Star Trek.
It's a very old school kind of attempt to put the team back together again on a rocky planet. And it really does feel like a Gene Roddenberry 1965 or 6, whatever it is, episode. Except all of those episodes would have a science fiction governing idea. And this hasn't. It's literally got a bad guy with an ultimate weapon.
Well, there's a wry aside at one point that's supposed to make us chuckle at the old series where Kirk says, my life has become quite episodic. Ha 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 ha. In fact, the film is entirely episodic because it's, here's a cool moment, here's another cool moment, here's another cool moment. The fact that there's no connecting arc of story doesn't matter because that's not how we make films nowadays. We just make cool moments and bolt them together.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the films at work actually do have, you know, even blockbusters. Why was Captain America Civil War a really good blockbuster?
Because it does have a connecting
thread. Because it's got connecting tissue and you care.
Whereas Batman versus Superman...
It's just a pair of guys punching each other for 2 hours.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, but it makes no sense.
Isn't length part of the problem with a lot of these films, though, that I find... Because everything now, the default is 2 to 3 hours, where it used to be 90 minutes. There always seems to be an extra act in the middle, which makes that part of that problem, that it makes these things feel episodic, because you don't get that same kind of arc. The point halfway through a film where you would start descending towards a conclusion now is now seems to be the point at which you have to plateau for 45 minutes and have another bit and another bit and another bit that you don't really need.
Yeah. I entirely agree.
That starts to shatter.
But it's also true of gigs. Gigs go on forever. I just half an hour, play the hits, mate, I'm finished. And similarly, CDs ruined albums when they were confined to like 20 minutes.
Well, Star Trek Beyond, I mean, on the plus side, the cast is pretty okay. I mean, Chris Pine as Kirk is not as annoying as he was in the first episode, where he was simply just a tedious brat. This guy's not a captain. Why would anybody follow this guy into destruction? You know, Zoe Saldana's quite good as Uhura. Carl Urban gets all the best lines as Bones.
He's the best thing in it.
Yeah, we see probably more of Scotty than we thought we would. That's because Simon Pegg wrote it and wrote a lot for him. Yeah, and it's really sad to see Anton Yeltsin as Chekhov in the movie, because he's dead in real life, and every scene with him in it is terribly poignant because he's young and he's full of life and he's got some funny lines. He's a likable character, but you're just taken out of the movie constantly by the fact the poor guy, you know, actually died in that.
Yeah, whereas there's a significant chunk of time given over to mourning Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah,
you know, there are.
In a completely pointless.
Yeah.
The whole thing I felt was really pandering. One of the key moments involves play
tribbles.
No, there's no tribbles. They play some Public Enemy, and there's a joke about how this is classical music, and they play the Beastie Boys. And, this old fashioned classical music. very pandering to today's kind of, you know, Trekkie audience, I think.
Yeah, well, again, we're overwhelmed by history. Yeah. Which is, you know, oh, let's think about the stuff we used to do.
Is it because is it a problem that they're actually referencing a TV series which the multiplex audience who go and see this film just won't have any idea what they're talking about?
I don't think that's the problem, because you know, people, you don't need to have seen the original Star Trek to know who Spock is. He's embedded in pop culture whether you've seen the show or not. To me, the problem is it doesn't do any of the good things that Star Trek used to do, which would to take a strange science fiction moment or a strange science fiction idea and then apply this interesting ensemble cast, all of whom represent a different part of the human mind. You know, the Enterprise bridge itself is, it's like the numbskulls or Inside Out. You know, you've got Spock is the intellect and, you know, Bones is the emotion and, you know, Kirk is the conscious mind and Uhura is communicating, all these kind of things.
Yeah.
And you apply this ensemble cast to a science fiction problem every week and somehow they solve it. Yeah. And this, none of that happens. It's just a bunch of explosions.
The meta things that you're talking about sound very much like Simon Pegg's Fingerprints. I mean, that's very Simon Pegg, isn't it? So he's written it, I suppose that's...
Yeah,
it is. That thing, it does sound like it's sort of the pandering to the bulletin boards kind of.
But I just wonder whether, you know, my complaints about it are completely outdated because the audience is 15 and it's going to go, "Hey, Starship Enterprise and stuff blowing up."
This is a common thought, isn't it? That the most important audiences are all 15. They aren't, because they can't necessarily. The people who are really spending the money on the Blu-rays and the cinema tickets are people of my generation still.
Yeah,
young people are. By and large, and obviously this is a silly generalisation because all generalisations are silly except this one, but, you know, they're streaming YouTube and they live in a different sort of suit. They don't want to own things like I want to own things. I've still got a pile of albums. My daughter, who is very interested in music, just listens to stuff on Spotify. The idea of owning an object or paying to go and see something is ephemeral.
Well, I don't know about owning an object, but I think there is... The fact that fandom is now so much bigger than it was means that... Young people want to own, not the object, but they want to own the thing.
Mm.
So the fanaticism behind Harry Potter, the fanaticism behind Hunger Games and, you know, the Avengers, it amazes me that this thing I liked when I was a teenager is now beloved of, you know, people like my teenage nieces who are really into it and they want to know, how's the relationship between Scarlet Witch and the Vision going to develop? Ooh, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
I'm amazed that you know who they are, let alone care. So there's ownership in that sense, in that there's personal investment in it. And, you know, my nieces are very invested in Star Trek. I haven't talked about this one, but I'll be surprised if they are particularly bowled over about it, because the previous installment, which is essentially a rewrite of Wrath of Khan with Benedict Cumberbatch as the Khan figure, I had problems with it because they didn't feel that it developed Star Trek properly. They thought it was a bit kind of like, that's just some stuff happening for no reason.
Mm. Well, this is more stuff happening.
It is. You can't deny that. A lot of stuff happens. What do we think of Idris Elba with a ton of makeup on him?
You also said that it was different makeup. It morphs in that kind of bugs
in an unexplained way. Why is it doing this?
Well, it's vaguely explained, and I don't particularly want to explain why.
Yeah.
For the benefit of people who want to now go and see it, the few people of like my age who still pay for cinema tickets, but it's vaguely explained, but it's not adequately explained.
Yeah.
But he morphs through the thing, and at sometimes you just think it's a continuity mistake.
Yeah.
Because you start noticing the change before they tell you why the change is happening.
See, that was what really bugged me about it. The fact if your movie is sort of nominally a science fiction movie, you have to explain your science fiction premises. You have to make things clear. Why is this happening? And the kind of orbital space outpost is beautifully rendered. This kind of three-dimensional wheel with artificial gravity and skyscrapers pointing in all lots of different directions. That makes perfect sense on screen because, you know, it visually explains itself. Mm. But the villain, you know, what's happening to him and why it's happening, they never bother to... It's, you know, just another director of Fast and Furious, as Bernie's about it, never actually bothers to tell us what's going on. And I think if as a science fiction movie, you can't be bothered to do that, well, what else are you shortchanging us on?
We've got a villain problem generally. I think the Marvel movies, which are, you know, seen as the pinnacle of blockbuster entertainment at the moment, they've got a villain problem. All their villains, with the exception of Loki, are weak.
Well, this is why Civil War is so good, because there is no villain. Yeah. It's all the heroes.
But also, going back to Marvel, they had loads of really good villains. Why haven't they, you know, why haven't they... I thought the reboot of Electro for the Spider-Man one was great, because it was an old original villain that people recognised from the comics. Whereas now it's some kind of celestial being come to kick over the Earth. You know, it's kind of... That doesn't draw on... What was great about the comics?
Always a cloud of dust now.
There you go. I'm saying Star Trek Beyond, I cannot recommend it.
I'm saying if you liked the previous two, and a lot of people do, then you'll like this one. a lot of stuff happens, but it's a very generic film.
Okay, well, there we have it. We are coming to the end of another show. And, of course, that means it's time for Closing Time Chatter. This is where we ask our guests for the idea or the story or the magazine article or the argument or whatever that's been obsessing them this week. Dan Mayer, I hear you are annoyed about company names.
Specifically, company names, shop names, restaurant names,
yes,
that follow the somebody and somebody format, but where the at least one of the two somebodies is not a name but a word.
Okay.
Now, like, you might think you don't know what the hell I'm talking about,
no,
but once
I do,
you start thinking about it,
ampersand names.
Ampersand names. Mm. Things like there's the shop Pull and Bear, for instance. I have no idea what that means and why it's called Pull and Bear.
Yeah.
I mean, neither of those things seems to be a name, but there's other ones where they slightly cheated. So there's a bakery chain called Baker and Spice.
Yeah.
Right, okay, I see what you're trying to do there. Yeah. You're trying to imply food, that it's a bakery. But there's nobody involved called Mike Spice.
No,
is there?
Danny so Baker why have you called Spice, which
Posh
is
Spice, yeah,
on the way on the bus on the way here, I passed
selling really expensive.
A bar. It's a cocktail bar that apparently does like 1920s detective themed cocktails, which is called Smith and Whistle. Again, another one. And within 30 seconds of this studio, you'll find the cafe Jackson and Rye.
Yeah.
There's no one called Rye. I get it, because it's American
it's
sandwiches,
like
it's rye bread.
Yeah.
And there's a cake shop called Cutter and Squidge at the top
Nobody's
of the range.
Nobody's called Squidge. Nobody says Squidge.
Stop doing that. Stop doing that thing. Well, stop calling your businesses two things where one of the things is not a person's name but a word.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the modern equivalent of the terrible hairdressers called Talking Heads or Scissor Sisters. Or, you know.
I assume it's done to sort of, to imply some kind of heritage that it's not a faceless brand, that some people started this thing up, but compromised by the fact that, well, we want people to know something about what the business does, so we'll put a word in that makes it sound like we're telling you something about the business. But it's just really irritating.
What about the subheading, founded October 2015?
By neither of the above names.
Yeah. Our branding agency told us that to look like we've got heritage, we should do this. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Michael Moran, I believe you're going to defend Pokemon Go for us.
I'd like to be the last journalist in Britain to discuss Pokemon Go and the epiphenomenal nature of its appeal, in that... Fine, it's a video game, or it's a mobile casual game, and there are lots of them. And a lot of people seem to be, you know, probably slightly more than the average, you know, some, more than Angry Birds, say, for example. People are liking it, and I think it represents something they can do on their phones that isn't looking at horrible news. So they're going around capturing these imaginary tortoises and whatnot. But many more people are talking about it than are playing it. You know, one of the things that really tickled me is the way that Nintendo's share price soared on the release of this thing, even though Nintendo make no money out of it.
And then collapsed when Nintendo had to say,
when people found
it's got absolutely nothing to do with us.
Told us something about the nature of like, you know, late capitalism and the nature of the people we are now.
And how little people understand what happens on the devices in their pockets.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, and the fact that it's if you leave it open, as I did, accidentally, then it will destroy your battery in an hour. Last night I went to the cinema. I went to the Star Trek. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Ah, right, yeah.
And on my way back, I noticed a number of people, mainly young people, and actually, do you know the way that you notice one thing and then you therefore, by extension, notice that thing again?
Yeah.
So I noticed lots of young women wandering around looking at their phones and not looking where they were going. And I was thinking, what an extraordinarily safe society this is, where people can do this, where, you know, attractive young women can wander around in city centres staring at their phones, and I don't know whether they're hunting imaginary chipmunks or what they're doing, or they're tweeting. It doesn't matter, but this is the world we live in, and we, you know, we're encouraged to think that it's a dangerous world and we should be worried. It's not. We are the safest people that have ever lived in all of mankind's history ever.
As Pikachu proves.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pikachu.
Matt, have you got a closing?
Yeah, I'm holding out hope for a new Netflix series called The Get Down, which is a musical drama TV series. It's about the birth of hip hop, and it's kind of slightly scary because we were all really excited about vinyl, and look what happened there. But I'm kind of pleased by the fact that, unlike vinyl, which had Mick Jagger and Scorsese behind it, this has got Nas, the rapper. Mm-hmm. And rather brilliantly, Baz Luhrmann behind it, which makes me think that it's going to be all singing, all dancing.
It's going to be a flamboyant Donovan.
It's probably going to be very pretty to look at.
And the trailer looks fantastic. It's got Biafro'd kind of rappers and scratching and stuff. It has Will Smith's daughter as the... now, this is what Baz Luhrmann has done, which is brilliant. He's realised that hip-hop wasn't created in a vacuum, and then at the same time the big musical style in the black community was disco.
Yeah.
So the kind of the love interest and the parallel story is Will Smith's daughter being brought up by her preacher church, black church mm-hmm. father, in fact wanting to sing disco.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's a big disco element
now,
in it.
I must say, I saw this as well, and I really like the look of it.
Well, my closing time chatter is I bought tickets for the David Bowie Lazarus play just because I wanted a last little bite of the Dame before it all sort of disappears into history. And it just made me think, you know, why can't we have... Why does everything have to be a jukebox musical? Why can't we have art mm-hmm. projects inspired by music? Why can't we have a Nick Cave murder mystery? Or why can't we have, you know... like experimental theatre involving weird shapes based on compact records and stuff like that. I like the idea that the Bowie Lazarus play is an actual play with music threaded through it rather than a jukebox musical yeah. with a yeah. string of, you know, the worst...
A bloke called Gene Genie.
Yes, yes. Hello, yeah. Gene. Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, having sat through both Mamma Mia and the Queen musical, and I'm not sure which was the worst experience, but just seeing songs threaded together pointlessly, it just made me think, you know, I haven't seen the Lazarus play yet, but I've my confidence is high, and I hope it will produce a new generation of interesting takes like that. So there we go. So that's our show. Thank you to Michael Moran and Dan Mayer for joining us. Remember, you can listen to this show again on audioboom.com, and you can also hear our past shows. Just go to audioboom.com and search for Big Mouth. That's audioboom with an M on the end. You can also subscribe via iTunes. If you go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth and hit the subscribe button. And if you have a moment, then please do give us a star rating, because that gets us more exposure, gets us up the charts, and is generally a good thing. So we'll have more quality pop culture talk for you next week. In the meantime, goodbye and have a lovely week.